I'm just fucking, like, stuck in this ridiculous, like, self-imposed fucking prison of,
I'm going to show you a series of pictures. You're going to tell me what you, the first thing that comes to your mind. Tell me what you see.
That's a pussy. Hey,
what about this one?
Looks like a cock on the side of a pussy.
All right, that's right. Tell me what you see, Frankie.
You know, think what you think about me. Hate me or like me, just don't misunderstand me. That's it.
If I was going to point anybody in the direction of, as far as in my opinion, what strikes at the heart of synchronicity today, I think there's something about your post recently that is a perfect primer. It asks the right questions, it provides the right evidence, and is just perfectly set up for somebody to, you know, you can easily dismiss it, but anyone thinking, I think, clearly has to dig a little deeper after reading that. So,
Yeah, I find that particular case pretty hard to dismiss in one way or the other, right? You've got to sort of make some unpleasant conclusions on either side if you get into that.
Absolutely. So what I'm going to open up with is a story about contact from the other side. I've only had one other instance where I could say I felt contacted from somebody on the other side, or had a sign that everything was okay, or led me to go down those roads of thinking. I lost someone very close to my family at a very early age, about 5 or 6 years ago. And after she passed away, it was some time, I think, like, well, she had gone missing for a while. And in the period with which she was missing, I had, in my heart of hearts, I had concluded that she was gone, but there was no confirmation on that. But it was during the time that she was missing, I was driving in a residential area going towards her family's house, and in the middle of the street in this residential area was this deer, just this majestic animal crossing the street with, you know, houses and yards and cars going up and down the street, and it was mind-boggling how it just sort of pierced the environment with its presence. And oddly enough, and not so oddly enough, but my mother was in a car very near, because she must have been leaving the family's house at that point, but she saw it too. And, you know, I think my mother is a person who's more open to interpreting things in that way. So we both kind of, like, when I got home, like, either the next day or that night, and I was like, oh my God, you'll never believe what I saw. And when I related to the story to her, she's like, oh, I saw it too. I thought the exact same thing, you know.
Wow.
We were just right there. And you can't convince anybody about, you know, is it true, is it not true, what does it mean? But all you know is if you're in that frame of mind and you experience a moment like that, you can't take away the feeling that it creates for you. And it was a very warm and peaceful feeling. You know, it was just a transcendent moment that I'll never forget, and I choose to kind of put it in that ballpark of some sort of communication from whatever you want to say it is, from heaven, from another dimension. But it was something about, you know, it just was a direct communication to me. So
and you had the feeling that deer was in some way this woman.
Yes, that it was.
Yeah.
You know, that whatever what happened happened, but life goes on, and it was like the spirit that she was, you know, in that moment, it was in that deer in that residential area. I've never seen a deer in a residential area before then. I haven't seen it after then. That's the only time I've seen that just remarkably out of place kind of moment. I mean, it's crazy too, because the area she was in, I mean, 3 blocks north or 3 blocks south of where the deer was is the expressway. Right. So if it traveled in the direction it was traveling, there was no way it was getting across the expressway. I mean, it was just inexplicable. But it was, you know, obviously memorable. But what I wanted to tie that into, yeah.
Just a sec. Yeah, this whole story, we can, you know, we can tie it in again afterwards, I suppose. But this reminds me of a very similar story that a friend of mine here told me about his sister who had died. He was living in Las Vegas. He's from Las Vegas. And his sister had died. It was like exactly a year afterwards. And somehow this guy, my friend, he and his friends were, I think they were dealing drugs or something. They were, I can't remember the background story, but they're getting chased by the cops all night or something, or something crazy like that. But he ended up alone at this cemetery at the edge of Las Vegas, right on the edge also of the desert, where his sister was buried. And it was really early morning. The sun hadn't risen yet. And he went to her grave. I mean, just in front of her grave. And this guy is not a religious guy at all. He's actually like a atheist, total skeptic. But he said that this rabbit came out of the desert, like not a normal cute fuzzy rabbit, like a big kind of desert hare came out of the desert into the cemetery, started circling around him and his sister's grave, like right where he was, and then actually came over to him, went down on his lap, yeah, and he had the sense, the total sense at that time that that was his sister. But it's weird because when he told me that, like it was quite a few years later that when he first told me that, but now he thinks it was just a weird experience. He doesn't know what it is, but he's totally rejected the idea that it could have been his sister. But yeah. at that time he was totally convinced of it.
Yeah. I mean, when you're in the power of the moment with these occurrences, your brain and your mind and your body are enveloped in a certain kind of feeling that's undeniable. And I just think it's so sad that people can become so disconnected from that. And even though the fact of the moment is right there with them, they can just reject that feeling that was associated with the moment, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, now he comes up with all the, like, these ideas that maybe this rabbit had been tamed or something at the cemetery, or like people had been feeding it or something. And but the fact is that wasn't his experience at the time, you know?
Right.
And the people tame rabbits in a cemetery, you know?
That sounds like a Kevin Costner movie or something. The Rabbit Tamer. You know, he's just doing it for the people. He doesn't want any publicity. He's just taming the rabbits.
But that sounds like a very similar story to yours, right?
Absolutely. What's interesting about that first occurrence was the other thing that I connect with that year and that month in particular was it's so weird. It's because, my God, I had gotten my first cell phone, right? Mm. And so I can't ever listen to the ringtone, like the standard ringtone for cell phones, because all I heard was that ringtone with the phone calls going back and forth amongst my family and friends of the family regarding this tragedy, right? Mm. And obviously the second cell phone I got, like that was my first cell phone, and it definitely changed my life, but it was also a very life-changing time for me.
Right.
And then I graduated to an iPhone after that phone broke. And, you know, obviously I always say that an iPhone is, you know, one of the top five life-changing gadgets to ever be created.
Right.
But so there's something about, and I'll get back to that point, I think, later. But here's the story that I want to get into. And Guillaume Simard, if you're out there and you're listening, here's my 43 story. Guillaume has been posting some really interesting, a really interesting sync thread with his experience with the number 43. And for me, this story culminates with the number 43. So I hope it's a good enough story. So here it goes. Last March, another person in my family passed away. A little bit more expected, but still a painful loss because of he had been suffering from cancer, and it looked like he was going to survive through the chemotherapy that he was receiving. And essentially, he was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer the year before, was not given very much long to live. But after a year later, had gained weight, had been doing strong, he had a stroke, wound up in the hospital, and died 2 weeks later.
Mm.
And it was a very terrible experience for him because they thought he was going to die, but then they revived him, and he was intubated, and he was clearly just being held on by technology. And by the grace of God, he was able to leave that, you know, that horror, that medical horror where you're kind of...
Right.
Yeah. So he passes away. And what I remember about him was he was a real grounded individual, but he spoke very clearly and very matter-of-factly about an experience he had in my grandmother's house where he said, you know, I talked to your grandfather. And this was a man who passed away 15 years earlier. He's like, I was in your... grandmother's living room, and I was doing some work, fixing a blind or something. And he's like, your grandfather spoke to me, and he just wanted to thank me. He's like, thank you for coming into my family's life. Thank you for looking after, you know, my wife and my daughter, and it means a lot to me. And he just sort of told the story, not as if it was meant to, blow my mind, but it was just sort of, hey, your grandfather, you know, I never got to meet him in person, but he spoke to me. And, you know, it's, and I'm of the mindset, and I'm a little bit more inclined to at least appreciate or entertain those kinds of things. So, you know, I was like, okay, that's cool. And I think that story led my aunt to share a story of her experience talking with somebody from the other side. Oh, she talked to my grandmother. After she passed away. So when this guy died, I thought to myself, I wonder when he's going to communicate with me. He obviously believed in this, so he's over there now, or wherever it happens. It would seem to me he would make it a point to try to reach out to somebody in the family and say, hey, blah, whatever.
I'm okay.
I'm okay, it's all good, or... fuck, this is awful, you know, some kind of report. So it's this happens on a Friday that he passes away. Well, Monday morning is my day off, and usually I spend a Monday by putting on my headphones, walking around the village, and smoking a little. And it's a good time. I'll walk for maybe 4 or 5 hours, and I'll just think of new story ideas, process thoughts, listen to music, and it's just the way I relax. And so this particular Monday morning, it was rather cold, so I had to bundle up a lot of layers. So it's early March, overcast. So I wake up, throw on my headphones, get bundled up. I smoke a little, and when I walk, I don't really pick a destination. I'm just walking anywhere that my, I don't know, it's just one of those things. You just walk. You know, you're going to walk and then you're going to end up home. So I don't even know where I'm going. I'm just walking into my own thoughts, into my own world. And finally, I have to go to the bathroom. And I think, okay, where am I going to go to the bathroom? And I realize the public library is a couple blocks away. So I head towards the library, walk up to the second floor, use the facilities, get out, and I'm kind of like taking off my hat and unzipping my coat. And I find myself at this couch. And as I take off my headphones and I take off my jacket, just kind of wondering, you know, what the hell am I doing? Where am I going next? You know, kind of just a little stoned and just kind of processing it. And I look up and I shit you not, right there in the middle of my vision, clear as day, on the bookshelf are two big books with the last name of this person who just passed away. And, you know, okay, skeptics can trounce all over that what they want. But all I can say is, here's a guy who passed away 3 days earlier. He talks about communication from the other side. And I'm in this, I didn't plan to go to the library that day. The bathroom was on the second floor. I chose this seat, you know, at random. I look up and there he is. There's his name. Clear as day.
And what about the titles of the books? Any clues there? Or?
I didn't even have to I didn't have to dig into the book. I didn't have to, you know. That's all I needed right there. That was the communication. Because, you know, where that book was on that massive bookshelf. I mean, it was perfectly aligned with my vision. I didn't have to look for 5 minutes and then, oh my God, look in this bookshelf, there's a book. I mean, it was staring at me before I was staring at it. And in that moment, I said, God bless you, George. There you are, right there in front of me. You know, I'm not gonna question it. I'm not gonna try to, you know, analyze it too deeply. There you are. And, you know, whereas that first story was the spirit came to me in the form of a deer, this was coming to me through letters, you know, on a bookshelf in a library. I look over to the right after a couple of minutes, and what do I see on the shelves? The whole row of Philip K. Dick novels. I mean, 10 feet away, there they are. I mean, it's just like, are you really? I mean, seriously. Okay.
Dick was in on it as well.
Absolutely. So now, okay, now we fast forward 2 months into the month of May. When this George passed away, we didn't have a formal wake or a funeral for him. He was cremated, and what we had decided as the family was that we were going to hold a memorial at my parents' house in May, so that everyone could make it. Some people wanted to come in from out of town, and it was sort of like, I don't know, it just made sense for everybody. So 2 months later, everyone's at my parents' house, and everyone's gathered in the backyard for a toast to George, you know, to his life. And he had this liqueur that he always loved. It's called Cuarenta y Tres. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I haven't, yeah.
But it's 43. Right?
Right. 43.
So there's, I don't know, 60, 75 people in the backyard. And everyone has a shot glass full of this liqueur, and we do this toast to our friend George, right? Shots of 43 for everybody. I do the shot. I go downstairs, and there was a table in the basement. And there was a big old-school Bible there, and there was pictures of him as a kid. And I see a piece of information, a piece of paper that has his birth date on it. And I never knew George's birth date. And I see that he was born in what year, do you think?
Could it be 1943?
Of course it's 1943. So he's born in 1943, and I think, holy shit. I wonder if that's why he had a particular affinity for this liqueur.
Right.
It would only make sense. And then I see he was born on March 4th, 1943, which is 43 backwards. It's 3-4. But I go, well, I say to myself, well, that's not the third 43, because usually these things happen in threes. I said, you know, I could spin it to like the European dating system, but I was like, it just put in, it planted a seed in my head. I said, the next time I see a 43, that'll be George, right? Mm. So, okay. The next day, I wake up. I had gotten a card on Saturday to go pick up a book at the post office. The book in particular was Philip K. Dick's Collected Letters, 1978-1979, right? So I couldn't pick it up because it was too late on Saturday. Post office is closed on Sunday. So Monday morning, first thing I do, I go to the post office to pick up this book. I'm standing in line, and it's a long line, and the woman behind the counter tells me to go over to the separate door and knock, because if people are just there to pick up things, that someone would come to the door and help me. So I go over to the door, and I notice this big poster on the wall. It's a collection of stamps, and I see Digitalis as the stamp, and it's a flower. So that makes me think of the book Valis, because that was the pills that girl,
okay, yeah.
She was trying to get all those, a handful of collection of Digitalis so that she could do herself in.
Right.
So I'm there to pick up a book by Philip K. Dick. I see Digitalis in this stamp collection, and I think, oh, that's funny. I look below it, and there's a stamp for another flower, and it says Cosmos. So, you know, that tickles my, you know, my spidey sense. And to the left of the Cosmos, there's just a stamp of this other flower, and it says Pinks. So I have Digitalis, Cosmos, and Pinks. So I'm thinking Pink Laser, Valis, Philip K. Dick. I'm picking up a Philip K. Dick book. This is sweet. I look over to the right, and there's a stamp that says PHLOX, which to me is like saying Phil or whatever. And below it, it says Zinnias, and I'm thinking Xena from Divine Invasion.
Yes.
So regardless, I'm sitting there, my head swirling with that sinky kind of energy. No one comes to the door. I get back in line. I finally get up to get my books. Well, I was there to pick up one book. It was the Philip K. Dick book. But there was another book rubber banded to it, which they had not... I hadn't gotten a card from the mailman to pick it up. They just bundled it. And it just happened to be a copy of Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy, which I had ordered after the Philip K. Dick book, and was just, oh, sweet. You know, I won't have to make two trips. So I take the two books, I get in my car, and I open up the Philip K. Dick book of letters, and the first page I see is Robert Anton Wilson's name. He had written the introduction to the book of Philip K. Dick's letters, 78-79. So my head is just wide open. I'm just like, this is fucking crazy. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a classic kind of sink zone where you're just, your mind is just crackling with energy. I pull out of the parking lot. I'm waiting at a red light, and I look up, and it's Harlem Avenue. And I realize, and it's been there probably for the last 10 years or however longer, that Harlem Avenue just happens to be Route 43. So I'm like, are you shitting me, you motherfucker? Like, it's like he designed the whole morning, put all these things there, and my third 43 right there, Harlem Avenue. You know, I looked at that sign a million times, but had never had a reason to look at the 43, but there it was staring at me before I was staring at it. And immediately I pull over to the side of the road and I Wikipedia Harlem just to see if there's any more dirt there to kind of enjoy. Well, the only entry for Harlem is the neighborhood in New York.
Right.
And the first nickname for Harlem, the neighborhood, is Black Mecca, which doesn't really resonate too much with George or me or the situation. But the other nickname for Harlem is Heaven. And the slogan for the neighborhood of Harlem is "Making It." So you want to tell, you can, you know, argue it all you want. A skeptic out there can slice me up and tell me I'm stupid. But I'm sitting there saying the next 43 I see is going to be a message or just a little sign for my friend who passed away. And, you know, the first time I saw his name on the bookshelves, on the same shelves as Philip K. Dick, the next time I pick up a book by Philip K. Dick, there's the 43, and it's connected to heaven and making it. I mean, I can't make this shit up.
Was he a fan of Philip K. Dick, you know?
No, he wasn't. Particularly. No.
Yeah, but maybe he knew that you were, or?
No, not at all.
But yeah, still, yeah, it doesn't.
But this is what I wanted to say. You know, I mean, this is sort of the conclusion I made. You know, this type of communication has been going on with human beings since we've known or called ourselves human beings, right?
Sure.
Okay. The form that this communication took at first, the first thing with the deer, it was an animal spirit type communication, and I could recognize it. Now, this story about George, the first communication was through letters, his name on the, you know, spine of a book, and the second communication came through numbers.
Right.
Now, in an information-soaked, media-rich environment, why shouldn't we assume that whatever this communication is, right, spirits from the other side, God, whatever you want to call it, doesn't it make a more economical sense to communicate through the things that you have at your disposal?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was at George's disposal in the right moments were a bookshelf, and the other time was just numbers. And that numbers and letters surround us. I don't think there's more numbers and letters than insects that surround us, but there's a shitload of them. And if you're able to perceive them, then this communication or this energy or this thing is happening through the numbers and letters that surround us. So the way that this, I think, ties into your blog post is, you know, either the coincidence of Unit 731 on that plane, you know, you can take the argument, A, it's just a coincidence, right? Mm. It's just something that happened and people are applying meaning to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it demands the application of meaning because I had never heard of Unit 731 before.
Mm-hmm.
And now I know about it and I'm a better person for having that knowledge, right? You better know your history or else you're doomed to repeat it. Like that's a story.
Yeah.
That's a story that everyone should know. Every time they see 731, they should think of Unit 731 and,
exactly,
and what that is. Just as much as people see 9/11 and say, "Oh, bad shit."
Yeah, I didn't know about it before that incident either. The first time I heard of it was when I came across this article of Abe sitting in that plane. But shocking, like it's hard to imagine that it is a coincidence or a synchronicity, and that it wasn't intentional. I can't see them not cluing into the fact that people are going to get upset because of this number. Like it's so obvious. I talked to a Japanese student the other day, and I asked him about Unit 731 just to see if he had any idea about it, and he knew right away.
Really?
But he hadn't heard this story. Like he hadn't heard about Abe sitting in this this cockpit. But so even so, though, this is where it all starts to get tricky, right? If that's the case, if it is intentional, then this is it's a conspiracy. It's by definition a conspiracy using symbols using really egregious symbols to create an effect. And the effect is, I don't know, to slowly build up provocative actions in Northeast Asia. And if you look at the policies of Abe's government, it seems like this is what's going on.
When you're in a meditation class, or you're just in a room full of people who are meditating, and I'm sorry if I don't use the appropriate language, but I'm relating this back to a story from college, you know, like 20 years ago, but you're sitting in a room, you're all meditating, and then the master will come around with a stick, and he'll whack you across the back.
In Zen meditation. Yeah.
Is this the Zen master, is the plane with the 731, is this the Zen master's stick?
It could be something like that. I don't know if you noticed at the end of that blog post, and this is tied into what you're saying about communication through numbers, is that while I was doing research into this thing on Unit 731, I noticed that this motor scooter that's parked right next to my house, every time I go out of my door, I see this motor scooter. It's a next-door neighbor's. And his license plate, it's only three digits, and it's 731. You know, it's like...
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's like communication, like... You need to write about this. You need to continue on with this. Maybe maybe it's a coincidence. It's hard to make any definite conclusions about these things, but
well, think of how many people have died, or how many people died in Unit 731.
Nobody knows. There's thousands, but
so there's thousands of voices who never got recognized. When they passed away there, they were hidden up and buried, tortured and thrown away. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Tying this into my little, mini, story there of communication. I mean, there's still an unsatisfied energy there. Right. Of people. So, that could be their communication to the world, and you're helping them to sort of reflect back into the place they left. I mean, like I said, this is just one angle one can take.
I wouldn't rule that out. Like, even if it is intentional manipulation of a symbol or a set of symbols, it could still be that, you know. It could be both at once, you know.
If it's a conspiracy, if this was something designed by what's the gentleman's name in the plane?
Abe. Yeah.
Abe. If this is a conspiracy, do you believe it was by Abe's people or by people opposed to Abe? And
no, it would definitely be by his government, and I can't see how he wouldn't himself be involved, because he would have to okay that picture, I would suppose. And then if you look at the background of Abe, his grandfather was also prime minister. I talk about this in my post. His grandfather was also a prime minister. His name was Kishi, Prime Minister Kishi, and he was a minister during the wartime government, and he spent time in jail initially after the war as a war criminal, but he was later released, and then he was never convicted, and then he went on to become the prime minister. And if you look at all of the politicians involved in this, in sort of the ruling party of Japan, the Liberal Democratic Party, they all have like vast family ties. It's all connected, and it all leads back to the wartime government. There was never really a split. Like, like in Germany, there was an obvious split between like the Nazis and then the governments that followed afterwards. But in Japan, it's all kind of blurry. So I think things are on the move here in a certain way.
Things are on the move to, in which direction, to be more explicit?
I don't know if you've been following, probably not, you probably haven't been following Japanese politics, but back in 2009, there was another party that got into power in Japan, the Democratic Party of Japan. It sounds like a Monty Python sketch or something. But the Democratic Party of Japan, and then there's the Liberal Democratic Party. But the first party, the Democratic Party, got into power for the first time. And it was really the first time, I think there was briefly a time when the LDP was not in power, but this was about one of the only times that another government got in. And they were just slaughtered by the media. They got in all this problems. Initially, they said that they would try to ease the U.S. bases out of Okinawa, and they weren't able to do that because of U.S. pressure, and so they lost tons of popular support. And then the big disaster happened in the north with the tsunami and then the nuclear disaster in Fukushima. And so they were sacked out of power, and then Abe came back. Abe was a prime minister for a while, and he came back, one of the only prime ministers in Japan who has come back. And he came back on this economic agenda, this it's so-called Abenomics. His whole thing is to inflate the Japanese money supply to try to ease themselves out of debt by making their exports cheaper. But if you really look into it, what he's doing, he realized that Japanese people were most concerned about the economy, and so he came in on an agenda to reform the economy, and he got in with a landslide. But his main concern, everybody agrees, is to try to change the constitution, which is a pacifist constitution, and take Japan into a more kind of militarist direction. And that looks to be what's going on.
See, I'm such a shitty political guy. I just don't even. It's funny. You asked me if I'm following Japanese politics. I don't even know if I follow American politics.
Well, it's probably a good idea.
It's just like,
it's a cesspool in any case, right? But,
I don't see how you win by following that soap opera.
Well, you don't win, but you're able to find out, I think, how things might be working. Like if I wasn't following that angle, I would just assume that this was a synchronicity, right? And sort of leave it at that. But I think that it's more complex than that, and I think it's always more complex than that. I think people run into problems when they say it's just a synchronicity, in a way that's as reductionist as saying it's just a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I never think it is just a synchronicity. I think there's a lot of things involved in synchronicities. And a lot of people who are very high up in power hierarchies, I think they also know the power of synchronicity.
Do you know the story about Henry Ford and the salt shaker?
No, I don't think so.
I'm going to paraphrase it real quick. But, you know, Henry Ford, billionaire, fair to say, or whatever. But, you know, he's like the Bill Gates of his era, you know, mm-hmm. revolutionizes manufacturing of automobiles. There's a guy who comes, he's a job interview candidate. This is how I remember it, but paraphrased. So he's a candidate for a position in Ford's company. He's being interviewed. He's being groomed. They go out to dinner. The food is served. The guy gets his plate, takes a salt shaker, dashes salt over the plate of food. They finish dinner, and Ford, after the dinner, thanks him for coming by, but informs him that he won't be hired. And he's like, what did I do? And apparently, the reasoning was Ford saw that he put salt on his food without tasting it. And that he didn't even take the time to investigate whether or not the food needed salt. He just blindly put it on his food. And that was enough for Henry Ford to say, no, that's not the kind of person that I want working for my company. And that story stuck with me my entire life, because when I heard it at, like, I don't know when even I heard it, I was a kid, but it wasn't too bizarre. I kind of was like, that kind of makes sense. I didn't know why. And it took, you know, many years later for me to go, yeah, you know, that's it, to unsuccessful people, that's superstition. To successful people, that's just how you, that's how you distance yourself to a certain extent. It looks stupid to other people. It looks rash. It looks crazy. But you know what? It really does make sense. It's a deep psychological underpinning of human behavior that speaks to larger elements of what is or something.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of you're talking about communication. I think a lot of communication goes on those levels, especially as we get higher up into the hierarchy.
Right.
But if you start to think of these things, like this unit 731 example, or this jet fighter with 731 on it, if you stop and consider if that was intentional, it's fucking evil, basically, you know.
Yeah.
It's like there's no other way to there's no other way to look at it, right? If that is intentional, it's the same. There was a Korean politician. This was huge in the Korean media, in the South Korean media, and in the Chinese media. It was all in an uproar about this. But one politician there said that it would be like Angela Merkel having a swastika on her plane, you know. But
yeah, that blew me away. That this was taken as, in the media, this was understood as being something very concrete, not woo-woo. This is legitimate. Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. This is. I think maybe Asia is more like that. They pay attention to symbols and numbers more. I don't know. Did you see the other example I gave? That was last year in China, on June 4th.
Yeah, that, you know what, that's funny. That took me like a second and third read through to catch for whatever reason. But I was like, okay, there's a connection there. And then I read it again. And I was like, wait, I don't see it. And it's right there in front of my face. And then I'm like, oh, 6489. It's the date on the date. And
right.
That was a particularly large dive in that market, right?
I don't know if the dive itself was
okay.
Significant or not. Like it was only 64 points, right? But just the significance of that number, and it was all over the place. Like people were going crazy about this in China. And in the Chinese community around the world. And so I think they do pay a lot more attention to these numbers than we might do in the West. So that's another thing. I can't see how the Japanese government would not be aware of that, you know, how sensitive people are to numbers here.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand what triggers mass emotional upheaval, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so my argument for sync in movies is always, and this is especially with Stanley Kubrick. It's a simple argument. It's that if you were going out to film a movie and you're filming like background shots to fill in city landscapes or whatever, and you get your footage back, you're editing your movie, and someone says to the director, hey, did you notice that, you know, in the background, 4 out of the 5 cars have 666 on the license plate? And the director goes, wait, what are you talking about? So they re-roll the tape, and he goes, look, there in the background, there, 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 there. And the director sees it and goes, well, that's fucking weird. I certainly didn't plan that. And maybe because the audience is, you know, sensitive to that, and he doesn't want them to get the impression that that's on purpose, he goes, fuck, we gotta go shoot more. We gotta reshoot those scenes because the shit popped up in it, and we just can't have it. You know what I mean? We can't take the chance that somebody notices it and it becomes this spiraling story, even though it's not real. The people can spiral it out of control, and we just can't have it. So let's go reshoot the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of the story is, well, then you have to take control of your environment, right? Why waste time and money? You might as well take control of your environment and make the license plates in the scene so that you don't... You have to sort of take control of your film so that you don't waste time and money, just from an economic standpoint, right? And then the whole thing becomes, well, if you take control of your scenery and you're putting all the information in, well, then you realize, oh, wait a second. I have now this power to trigger certain reactions. And it's through that understanding and controlling the information in your lens that this whole argument, I think, comes to life. You know, it's born out of accident, but then once the accident happens, you have this new science or this new method that you would never think of by yourself, but it only evolves out of these happy accidents.
Yeah, it's hard to say how accidental it is. I guess that's always the big question, right? Like in the case you mentioned, even if there were these license plates in the background with 666 on them, how did they get there? You know, like what communication was happening there to even get them in the scene in the first place, right? Or so it could be on that level. It could be on the level of the director deciding to leave it in, or it could be on the level of somebody working on the film who's just playing around and wants to put in symbols without the director even knowing it. Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff that could be going on, you know.
Well, it seems
and is going on, I think, you know.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's no way that there are people in place, if somebody as powerful as Abe, there's no way that that number on that plane gets released in a photograph without at least recognition of its existence. It does not get past the radar, because if that could get past their radar, then how could you trust them to run your country?
Yeah, exactly. So given that, then, if we accept it in that case, which is particularly dark, I would say, you know, it's not like, it's even worse than saying 666, you know, something like that. Like 666 is pretty abstract now for most people, right? But something like that, 731, it's, there are thousands of people whose deep family memories are tied in with that number, right? And you have to remember in Asia also how important the cult, I want to call it, of the ancestor is, you know? Like people are constantly going back to the place, the hometown where their grandfather lived or their grandmother lived, and honoring them in death. Like there's a time called Obon in Japan where it's a special sort of holiday period, and that's what people do. They go back to their original hometown to honor their deceased grandparents or ancestors, right? So So that's in the mind of thousands, probably tens of thousands of people, right? It's not an abstract thing at all. So yeah, it would be very surprising if that just slipped through by accident somehow.
Does it for you? Because I can basically say that that the number was allowed to be in that picture. That there's no way that the sort of emotional upheaval alerted Abe and his people and like, oh, we fucked up. Like, so they knew the number was there. They knew that there was a certain amount of the population who could get upset or question it. Is that decision to allow the picture and allow the number to be represented, does it necessarily have to be a nefarious kind of decision, or can it spark a discussion that leads to a general awareness of numbers are not the problem, right? Like, where do you stand? Where did the people that you've talked to, is it necessarily evil, or what is your gut feeling on it? It's taking the stance that this is not something that slipped by their radar.
Imagine, like, it go back to the example of Merkel and her plan. If she had a swastika on her plan, but even it, I don't even think that's enough. You know, it would have to be, the plan would have to be called the Auschwitz or something. Like Unit 731 was the Asian Auschwitz, right?
Mm-hmm.
So imagine Merkel does a photo op in this plan that's called the Auschwitz. You know, like what, like how else can you interpret that? Like what would she be trying to do with that? You know.
Well, that speaks also to the difference between letter and number. Why is it that Japan chose to call their Auschwitz essentially 731, yet Germany didn't call their building, you know, 999? They gave it a name, like a stand, like all those camps had a lettered name. Does that speak to the difference in those cultures?
Yeah, I'm not sure of that. Like the it did have a name. Like this unit 731 had a horrendous Orwellian name that I can't remember. Right, but
a very stiff sort of by like yeah.
What is it called? The Epidemic Prevention and Water Purification Department of the Kwangtung Army.
Jesus Christ.
I don't know. I'm not sure if there's any meaning behind the fact that this is a number and Auschwitz is a name. I'm not sure. Like Auschwitz is, not only Auschwitz, but that the Holocaust is of course associated with a number as well, which is 6 million, right?
Right.
Yeah, so if you look at it from a Western point of view, if the German government did do something like that, there would be hell to pay, you know? They couldn't get away with it conceivably. Like it would almost be impossible for her to do something like that, right? I'm not sure about this. I'm not. Maybe it doesn't have the sort of impact that it does in the West. But from all that I've read and looked at, it does.
Can you imagine if Michelle Obama got pregnant, right? While Obama was in office, and the baby was born on September 11th of whatever year it was, do you think that they would fudge the actual birth date of that child and say it was born on 9/10 or 9/12, or would they just let the information be?
Well, I don't know. They could spin that in a different way, though. Like, 9/11 sort of different than this case, because in 9/11 you can spin it as it was evil done against the U.S., right? And so now it's turned into, what is it, Patriots Day or something, right? So you could even, like, if Michelle Obama had a kid born on September 11th, it could be, this is our new patriot, you know? This is our way of turning a bad day into a good thing, you know? Like, you could spin it in a certain way, right?
Well, I think that the healthy-minded people who would take, who would be, if you force the healthy people into a corner to say that a birth on that day had any significance at all, they say, well, if it has any significance, then maybe you could say blah, blah, blah. But the side of, kind of population that I think would get, you know, up in arms and find immediate satisfaction in the birth of an Obama child on September 11th, I think that mindset, the majority of that mindset who finds immediate relevance in a date like that, would find it to be somehow nefarious in some level. Like, you know, I swear to God, man, I heard really rational people when Obama get elected say, in a sort of questioning, quasi comedic, but it might be serious tone, like, you know, some people think that Barack Obama's the Antichrist. And kind of just throwing that lure out there for somebody to go, yeah, man, I think he is too, so that they could, like, release those doubts. But really, like, clear-headed people that I know kind of floated that little fishhook out there looking for someone to kind of go, I know what you mean. I understand.
Wasn't that the same thing, like, back even with Reagan, you know? His name is Ronald Wilbur Reagan, and so every one of those names has six letters in it, so it comes up with 666.
Well, it's like Ferris Fremont, right?
Yeah, exactly, right?
Well, I don't know if that was 666, was it?
F is, yeah, it is six, yeah, it's 666.
Well, Fremont, Fremont, that's seven. But
the F is a six.
Oh, that's what it was. Ferris F. Fremont.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think it all goes on different levels. Like, the other part of this 731 story, as I looked into it, was the X-Files, right? And I didn't know this until I was researching this, but they did a couple of episodes on Unit 731, taking it into 90s America, right? Like, assuming that Operation Paperclip, which brought Nazi scientists into the States, also brought Japanese scientists into the States as well. And so there's a couple of episodes of the X-Files where there was this camp of Japanese scientists, initially established by the U.S. government, who were doing all these experiments that were, it was a complete continuation of what was going on in Unit 731. But the X-Files spin on it was, they were abducting people in a way that, like, they abducted Agent Scully in a way that seemed like she was abducted by aliens. And then the other side was that possibly they're coming up with alien human hybrids at these camps. So this takes it into a different level, right? So this takes it into the level of these people, these kind of crazed scientists at Unit 731, who were abducting people, who were experimenting, like, crazy experiments on people. And at the same time, other parts of the army were abducting women as comfort women, as sex slaves, basically. Very similar to, like, the gray alien abduction narrative that has exploded in recent decades. So if we take it on that level, it's yeah, it's a whole other different level of manipulation that might be going on.
You know, I just noticed that 7 times 31 is 217, which is the name for room 237 in the novel The Shining.
Interesting, okay.
And the only reason I bring that up is, well, it's already 7-4 for you right now.
Yeah, it's 7, I realize that, it's 7-3 for you.
And 2 minutes, it'll be July 4th, 2013. And, you know, I'm probably not the first person to think of this, but I certainly didn't read it anywhere before I thought of it. But 1776 plus 237 is 2013. So 2013 becomes room 237 in the American experiment. And so in 1 minute, we're going to be in year 237 of the American experiment.
Oh, interesting.
So this unit 731, which is 7 times 31 is 217, it just is sort of a little hop, skip, and a jump to the source material for The Shining. And obviously there's a lot of conspiracy theories that are woven into the narrative extracted from The Shining.
Yeah, it's I sort of had that in the back of my mind when I was coming up with the title of this, like Cockpit 731. It's like room 237. It's, it's basically the same thing. It's like this concentrated evil in a certain way, you know.